Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
Don't fish with flies that have too long tails in the winter. It seems like pike have a tendency to attack more often behind when the water is cold, as to when it's warmer, they attack more from the side. So you will have a lot of takes just, you know, maybe just attacking. If they take the fly directly from behind it, it only...
That was Morten Valur with a nice little tip for your next pike trip. The man behind A-Rex Hooks, today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today. We'll help you on your fly fishing journey with classic stories covering steelhead fishing, fly tying, and much more.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Morten Valur, who has one of the hottest hook companies on the market, is here to tell his story. We find out about some of their new hook surprises coming up this year, find out which resources he recommends for streamers, and who he thinks you should be following. Stay here till the end with a little nice bonus that I'm going to tuck in if you stick around to the very end. So without further ado, here's Morten Valur from arexhooks.com. How's it going, Morten?
All good here in Denmark.
Awesome.
Sun is shining. Yeah.
Nice.
It's a really nice day. It's the middle of the summer here now, and fishing is great. So yeah, all good here.
That's cool. Yeah, we were just kind of just briefly chatting off here. I've interviewed a few people. I think Martin Jorgensen is one from your neck of the woods, and I've had a few people over around Europe. But this is great to dig into it, because your name and your company has come up quite a bit, especially talking about pike and some other fly tying and stuff. So I'm interested to hear how that all came to be. But maybe you can just first talk about how you first got into fly fishing and then how that came into your company.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Maybe not a short one to answer, really. I'm 55 now, almost 55 at least, and I've been fly fishing since I was 18, but started fishing when I was 5. I grew up very close to a small pond, and as everybody else, I started fishing there. And actually, the company is only 200 meters from the pond, so I'm kind of back to my roots doing this now. But I've been in the industry, fly fishing industry, since I was 18. Worked in a shop where we had general sporting goods, you can say, and fishing was one of them. And there I started fly fishing as well. So I was 18 when I started fly fishing.
Did you just jump into, as far as species, was it brown trout, pike? What was the first thing you got into?
As a kid, it was, I think, mostly perch and smaller species like whitefish. That's in the lake down here, in the small pond here. And when I grew older, I started pike fishing when I was start riding my bikes around my area here, and we have a lot of small pike lakes here, so that was the next species on my list. Brown trout and sea run brown trout came on later, actually, when I was a grown-up. So I grew up with perch, whitefish, and pike, I would say. That's the main species from the beginning.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Yeah. So you started, so you're in the shops over there and getting into that. And then I know you've written some books and some articles. And then how did you bring that all into that? Yeah, maybe you can talk first about your books and then how you brought that into the company, A-Rex Hooks.
Yeah, because when I was in the shop for maybe 6 or 7 years, and then I took some more education. And back in 1995, my brother and I actually started a wholesale company just selling fly tying materials, mainly here in Scandinavia. And we've been doing that for almost 25 years, actually. We just sold that company a couple of years ago. And then out of that came Arix. And the main reason, actually, was I don't want to blame other hook brands or anything, but we experienced a lot of difficulties in having all hooks in all sizes in stock all the time.
Oh, yeah.
So I kind of felt there was a market out there. And I didn't know if we could do it better or not, and time will tell. But that's the route to Arix, actually. So we've been in the industry for many, many years now. And but then again, there's two things here. One thing is the fly fishing and what we are, our passion, and the other thing is the you can call it the business side of things. But to me, it's the same. It's a passion both for the fly fishing and for the hooks as well. It's a way of living, actually. I think a lot of people in this industry can recognize that. It's and guides and you probably as well. It's hard to keep those things apart.
It is. I was just editing a podcast. I can't remember who it was, but they were talking about that same thing, how, you know, you might not make a bazillion dollars, you know, but it's just a way of life. And it's a pretty, oh, I know who it was.
Exactly.
It was Matt Calise, the, you know, with Loon Outdoors. And he was saying that, he said, you know what, I asked him the question, he's got some kids. He's got a 7-year-old that has caught like 8 fish over 20 inches already. And I'm like, so if that kid becomes a guide, are you good with it? And he was like, yeah, I think it'd be awesome because he loves the industry.
Yeah.
Is that how you feel? You kind of love the industry?
Yeah, for sure. I know Matt quite well, actually, and I have the highest respect for him and what he's doing. And I totally agree. It is, as you said, you'll never be super rich selling fly hooks. Yeah. I know that. But it's a fun job. You meet a lot of people. You can do what you like and love. And I think that's probably more important than anything else. And I think, from what you're telling, Matt is sharing that the views on that. I agree. It's how it is for us, at least, for sure.
That's cool.
So
Who are the other? Who's the other big company? I mean, I guess is Partridge the? Are there how many companies are there competing with you guys in your neck? You know, in Europe, I guess, or that whole.
Yes, there's a lot of brands out there.
Oh, okay.
Partridge, Gemco, Gamakatsu, Firehole.
Yep.
Kona, there's a lot of brands, and I think, and the thing is, actually, to be honest, I think all these companies make a lot of very good hooks, and you can all say, why are we better or anything? I don't think we are better, but I think we have come up with a few designs that people like and think they would be very useful for their fishing. I think some of the hooks we made for Muskie, for example, has been quite well received, and I think that actually comes out of our interest in fly fishing ourselves, and we have a kind of an idea how a hook should look and how it works. But I wouldn't say that we are much better than anybody else. I think we're very focused on what we are doing, and we don't pay too much attention to what other companies are doing. I know them quite well because we've been wholesalers back in the day, so I know them quite well and have respect for them, and they're doing a good job, and we just try to do just as good job, I would say.
Exactly.
Well, yeah,
and your hooks and that, and I, you know, like I said, there's been a few people that have talked about, you know, when I ask the question which hooks, occasionally I ask what hooks you use, you know, and your name comes up. So when you talk about the muskie or pike hooks or some of that stuff, or just streamers in general, can you describe your hook and how maybe it is a little bit different than something else that's out there, or how it's unique?
Yeah, I think it's actually two things you're asking about here, because I want to separate it a little bit. If you look at the predator side, if you look at pike and muskie, that's one thing. Then you have the whole scene around the what we call trout predator, guys hunting for big trout with big streamers. You have a lot of well-known names out there doing that. And I think that's a pretty, that's a growing thing, I would say. So I think both areas, if we start up with pike and musky and even maybe some of the bigger saltwater species as well, I think we have a fishing pike myself, I think, and we all do over here actually, I think we have a pretty good idea how the hook should look. And it's something to do with weight of the hook and hook gap. Yeah. If you build big streamers, you want still want a big hook gap, and you want it strong enough so you can't make them too light. If it's but if you have a surface light, you want it lighter and all that. Yeah. And I think we know that. I think we got that in our blood and know how we want the hook for exactly that. And I think that is recognized by mm-hmm. both pike fishermen and musky guys. So, yeah.
Yeah. Gotcha.
But when it comes to the trout side of things, we don't have these big trout over here. And it's not, I think it came out of America, or US, the hunting for the big yeah. trout. And, but we have one guy over here who's really good at it, and that's Andreas Andersen.
Oh, yeah.
You probably yep. heard that name oh, yeah. as well.
Yep.
And he's a very good friend of mine, and he helped out creating a building, more or less, all the hooks we have in that category. And that was out of his experience from the U.S. and being friends with Ross Madden and a lot of the other guides in the U.S. So we got a lot of intel from really very experienced anglers and fly fishermen on that series of hooks. So gotcha. I think that's what we're doing. We are some of the things we know ourselves from experience, and where we don't know anything, we listen to the people yeah. doing it every day.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. That's awesome. Okay. So basically, yeah, I mean, like you said, one of the biggest tips is you listen to your customers and your people to let them tell you what to do. I mean, can you describe the process for somebody who doesn't know how a hook, I mean, you could talk a lot about the design, you've talked a little bit about there, but how does a hook actually become, what does that process look like? Where does it, you know, from your idea, from a design, you're out there fishing and you think, you know, you're going to do this. Can you talk a little bit about the manufacturing and how all that works?
Yeah, for sure. I think it always comes up as an idea when you're fishing, actually, or maybe mm-hmm. not ourselves, but friends and people just writing. We have this kind of fishery. We really need a hook that looks like this. And then we look into that and see if there's any. One thing for sure we need to check is there a big enough market to do this? Because one of the issues with hook manufacturing is the amount of hooks you need to order just to right. make a new design. So
how many is that? What typically on average, how many do you use? Like a yeah, 1,000 or a 10,000 or?
We are looking, most companies today we're not manufacturing the hooks ourselves. We're working with both Japanese, Norwegian and French hook manufacturers who are specialists in doing that. And they will make you the hook you want. And it depends on which company you're working with. But most of the companies are asking 100,000 hooks per size. So
wow,
so you need to be pretty sure that it's a hook that will.
Have you had a situation where you got 100,000 hooks and they weren't good? You couldn't sell them?
No, not yet.
Yeah.
But then again, I think we are different from other companies as well, because we don't mind actually if a hook doesn't become a huge seller or anything, if it fills a gap and there's enough enough people wanting it, we're fine with that. We don't mind stocking a hook for maybe, let's say, a size in one model for several years. It's not as long as we have other models and sizes that sell okay or well, I think we're fine with having sizes that don't do that. So I don't think we will ever discontinue models and just because it's not selling. Gotcha. I think you need to still be able to buy these special. I know it for myself. I've been tying flies for more than 30 years. And I think you get pretty annoyed when you found a hook you really like and then this thing's discontinued. I think a lot of people can recognize that. And I don't like that. So I kind of promised myself that we wouldn't do that.
Oh, cool.
We'll see in 10 years. You can ask me again in 10
That's
years
right.
if we did it.
That's right. See if you're still going strong. Or, and you mentioned a bunch of companies at the start. Do you, is is it pretty much all those big companies? I mean, you're one of the big companies now in the world, and you know, in hooks. I mean, are they all using kind of the same companies for manufacturing, or are there just a bunch of manufacturing companies?
Yeah, I'm to be honest, I'm not 100% sure about the different brands, but I know, I think, in, to my knowledge at least, I know that Gamakatsu have their own production.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I was just asking about, curious on the, you know, the manufacturers, but it sounds like that the, you don't know exactly, but there's probably a number of different manufacturers for some of the big brands.
Yeah, it's no secret who makes the hooks actually in the world. It's Mustad, it's VMC, it's a lot of Japanese companies. They are manufacturing the hooks, and I think most of us are using these manufacturers. And the thing is, you could say, why doesn't the big companies do this themselves? And they do. A lot of these companies do have their own fly hooks as well. I think the reason why there's a room for companies like us and other companies alike is that we're specialists on fly fishing. And you know, fly fishing is a special group of people, and all fly tiers and fly fishermen have their own ideas how a hook should look, and maybe these bigger companies all don't always have both the time and interest in doing such small numbers, to be honest, which fly fishing is compared to maybe spin fishing for bass or something else. So I think there's a room for small companies like us and others to accommodate this and make the hooks that the market or the fly tires want.
Yeah. That makes
sense.
Yeah, it does. So basically, so looking at the process, you have an idea, you have some concept in your mind, you maybe send the company over a sketch, or do you do some sort of a like 3D CAD design, or do you just send over a design and then they get it and then they can just produce it and send, do you get some samples that you can take a look at and actually use?
And then
you test it, then you say, okay, this is good to go, and go for the next, then they send you an order.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's actually how it works, and that's a process. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Perfect.
We normally just get one size to check, and that's also enough. You can just, it is a different thing to have the hook in your hand, maybe tie a few flies on it, and you notice that maybe the shank should be 1 millimeter longer or something like that, and the gap was a little bit too small, and it's small adjustments in the end, but they are pretty important, I would say. It's always the last small touches that makes the hook great, I would say. It's in my opinion, at least.
Yeah. How is the hook, you know, the sharp, you know, the point and the sharpness of the hook? I mean, can you talk about that? Or is that pretty common that most of the good companies have a similar, you know, the point stays sharp, you know, how often? Maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah.
How often do you have to sharpen your, or do you sharpen when you're out there fishing for, say, pike?
I'm old fashioned.
Yeah.
So I do. Honestly, I don't think a lot of the hooks you see out in the market today, most of them are really good quality and are what you call chemically sharpened. So, but then again, you know, yourself, if you fish in a lake with rocks and all that, and you'll hit a rock now and then you have to resharpen it for sure. And I do that. I think that's important to stay sharp all the time. Mm-hmm. So, but I think out of the box today, almost all hooks today are really good quality, I would say. So you don't have to do it that often, and they are stronger today in the point than when they were maybe 10 years ago. So a lot of things have changed, to be honest. And the process how they do it is more accurate, and
Gotcha.
It's very, actually, honestly, it's very, I think it's difficult to find a really bad hook out there today. It's most companies are doing a really good job now.
Gotcha. So if you're out there fishing for whatever species, pike or browns or anything, after you catch a number of fish, do you find that with your hooks, or, I mean, should you have a sharpener with you to keep it sharp? Is that something?
No, not if it's only catching fish. I would say you don't need to sharpen it. It's more when you
drag in the bottom,
you get stuck in the bottom or hit a rock or something like that. Then you might want to resharpen. But Otherwise, I think you'd be fine with our hooks. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up, you know, Mustad, you mentioned Mustad. I grew up the, I think it was the 36890, the steel, you know, it was our steelhead hook, the up eye, the black. And man, I mean, I still have those hooks. I got piles of those things. And, I mean, if you look at that hook, say back when you started in the 80s or, you know, early 90s, you know, do you have, first, maybe what is your hook? What would be your recommendation for a replacement for if somebody was fishing for steelhead? Or I guess you could maybe say Atlantic salmon. What would you say? What would be the comparable hook you guys have now?
Are we talking about a hook to tie on, or do you use a? Do you think a tube? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wasn't even thinking tubes, but yeah, I was thinking hooks to tie on. Do you guys do a lot of? Maybe you can talk about that. Yeah, do you do a lot of both?
Yeah, because I think in Scandinavia, tube fly fishing have taken over quite a lot from standard hooks, flies tied on a hook. So yeah, we do both tube singles, tube doubles, and yeah, over here we're allowed to use tube trebles as well. Even though that is changing, I think you're seeing more and more fisheries asking for either tube doubles or an even tube singles, which is a good thing. I think we are moving in the right direction. You've been doing this for many, many years and only allowing people to fish with tubes, singles, which is a great thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's down to tradition, honestly. Yeah. It's been there's a long tradition for using trebles in both UK and Norway, Sweden, and even in Denmark. So, yeah, but it's changing. When it comes to salmon or steelhead hooks for tying, we do have a few, two hooks for tying steelhead patterns on them, but we even have a few trailer hooks for if you tie
intruder or whatever.
Intruders and exactly. So I think we got it covered now, but it is one of the areas we want to expand to. Mm-hmm. To be honest, and one of the hooks, and I'm actually telling a small secret, but I'm fine with doing that with you. Yeah. We'll actually be introducing a bumper hook this fall, and some good guys in the US has been involved in that. Steve Silverio is one of them. You probably knew from Regal. He's been involved. Yeah. So he's been very helpful in that design and how it should look. So that'll be out in the fall.
And what is that hook? Can you say that again? What was that called?
A bumper hook for bumper flies, dry flies.
Can you clarify exactly what that is?
You know, the deer hair fly where you have a haggle wound through it. So it looks like a...
Oh, yeah.
It is colored. I don't know. I don't have another name for that. I think it's called bumper.
Oh, it'd be like bumper. like a bomber fly. Bomber. It's just a basically spun or stacked deer hair with a hackle going through the middle. Kind of a... use it for a dry fly for steelhead or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
And that's one of the new additions for the fall.
That's right.
Actually made right, we think.
Yeah, that's right. Does that have a big, I guess like you mentioned the gap, does that hook have a bigger gap or I guess any deer?
Exactly, that's one of the issues. Yeah, right. That's one of the issues with that kind of hook. It's very important that you don't get the gap. The gap must have to have a certain width. Otherwise, you know, you will miss a few fish because you have the deer hair and it takes up the space underneath the hook and all that. So we're taking that into consideration. So it's,
Cool. And, I mean, there's obviously a ton of things we can go down some paths here. I mean, do you have, as far as the history of some of the hooks and kind of hook design, would you consider yourself kind of a history buff, or is that something that you maybe don't know as much about? I'll just ask the question. The question I was thinking was, you know, again, going back to these older hooks, you know, the Sproat, Limerick, there's these different names for styles of hooks. And I don't know, is that still kind of around? And do you have different names? I mean, how do you name your hooks? Obviously, you have a numbering system, but can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually funny you ask, because I think a lot of these names is still around and we use them as well. A Limerick, for example, for the bend, it's still a very popular bend, and we are using that on both our wet fly hooks, and we're working on a new on a new stream hook as well, where we have the Limerick bend, and I think it's still very appealing. You even see one of our hooks having an Aberdeen bend. So I think you know, even though we think we are innovating and doing new stuff, we're still stuck in tradition. Yeah. And I think we should be. It's not a bad thing. I really like that. You know, growing up with fly fishing, it's pretty important. There's still some things that are recognizable, and I like that, and we do that as well. And when it comes to naming, that's really, really difficult. It's you know, it's so easy that you put on a name and a hook, and then you kind of you categorize it in one way. But and back in the days, I think people were looking at that name and saying, okay, this is a pikehood. I can't use this one for bass or trout or anything like that. But that has changed. I think most people today is just looking at the hook and say, okay, this is a nice hook. I can use this for whatever I fish for. So it's so to be honest, I would rather prefer not to give the hooks a name. We do it anyhow, but it's... We shouldn't, to be honest. It should just be a number so people can make up their own opinion on what they wanted to use it for. But
That's a good point.
We're a little bit stuck in tradition and put on a name anyhow.
Yeah. That's a good point. I wanted to dig into pike here in a couple of seconds. But before we get there, can you just talk about maybe what your most popular hook style or number, you know, what is your most popular hook you guys sell?
Yeah, it depends on where you are in the world. I would say if you're looking in the U.S., I think the hook we call Trout Predator, it's TP610 to be precise. Mm-hmm. That's probably one of the most popular hooks we have. And I think number two now is the 6-odd big stinger hook for muskie. But it's also down to seasons a little bit. So if the muskie season is on, we sell more muskie hooks. If it's a trout season, we sell more trout hooks. And the last couple of weeks it's been hex because the hex is hatching. So it is very much down to it's a seasonal sales more or less now, because I think a lot of people still tie flies when just the night before they go fishing. I do that. So
that's awesome.
So yeah, I think that's still a lot of people are still doing it, even though that during the corona COVID-19 crisis, I think a lot of people have been tying flies just the night before they're going fishing, but
that's right,
just tying flies in general.
How is COVID in your area in Denmark?
We are fine now, actually. I think we are more or less back to normal. We've been very fortunate that
no kidding.
Our government has taken good care of all this, I think, we still need to take care. I think we all do. It's still, I think a lot of people in Denmark kind of forgotten now that we even had a COVID-19 pandemic.
Are there people still wearing masks around there?
No masks in Denmark at all.
Look at that. And did you go through a phase where you had masks?
No, in Denmark.
You didn't have to have it. That's the amazing thing here is we're like the example of probably the worst case scenario of, you know, how we handled it, because we're going through a second phase now of, you know, it's this crazy thing. We're actually having an increase in, so it's this bizarre thing. But no, it's good to hear things are good in your neck of the woods.
I agree. It's good to hear. But I think we all need to still pay attention. Even though it looks quite good now, I think still things we need to pay attention. I think everybody should do that and take care of each other and keep a distance and all that. I think this isn't over yet, to be honest. And we do see a small outbreaks here and there in Denmark, but they're really taking good care of that. So, and trying to track where it came from and all that. So we just cross our fingers.
That's the key. Has your time, obviously I met you, I think at, IFTD last year. A lot of that's been canceled. Has your year, you know, over the next year, what you're looking out over the next year changed quite a bit now that the travel has kind of changed?
Oh yeah, for sure. And there will be almost no travel at all. And I think we've been talking about this. I think that will change how we work as well. I think a lot of meetings will be held like we do now on Skype or Microsoft Meetings and all these new things. And I think I think that will change, and I think we'll travel less than we did before. Even though I think the airline companies would like that we travel a lot again. I think they're hurting a lot, but I don't think we will travel as much as we did before. And yeah, I think we'll do other stuff, maybe more meetings online, and maybe keep it down to a few meetings a year traveling.
That's it. That's it. Yeah, things will change for sure. Well, let's dig in. I know you mentioned Browns and Pike, but I've had obviously some big names, Kelly Gallup, and I guess Kelly Gallup's more streamers and stuff like that. But Gunnar Bremer was on, and I'm sure we talked about you guys on that show. We talked a little bit about Pike, but yeah, let's talk about Pike in your neck of the woods. Can you describe, maybe take us to your home water? It sounds like you fish more Pike in lakes. But can you bring us to the water, talk about maybe if you have a water you want to describe and name, or if you want, if not, just talk about how you catch pike there.
Yeah, I do two things, actually. We're based in Denmark. It's a pretty, if you look at the maps, Denmark's a pretty flat country. I think the highest point we have here in Denmark is 190 meters high, which is, it's nothing.
No, 600 feet, yeah, a little hump.
It's like a pancake. So yeah, it is like it lakes in Denmark, and I do travel quite a lot to Sweden to fish for pikes as well, especially in the northern part of Sweden, which reminds, I think, probably is very looks very much like Canada. I would say, like, it's more mountainous and it's more pristine as well. It's a beautiful area. So it's two different things. I think back home here, we got a lot of agricultural in the area, and some of the lakes are maybe over fertilized a little bit, so that's what we are facing here. So my pike fishing, I do most of it in the winter because the water is clearer, and the fishing is maybe not easier because it's winter, but it's I prefer to fish in clear water, to be honest.
Gotcha.
And the lakes do get green in the summer and all that, so it's winter fishing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And most of that fishing is done in smaller lakes, shallow lakes. I prefer, to be honest.
What would be a small size lake?
Yeah, what's small? It's
I'm thinking
2 acres, maybe.
2 acres, okay.
Something like that's pretty. I think that's small in my world. So it's and they're not deep, maybe 3 to 6 feet deep is my what I prefer, because you can always, we do have bigger lakes here and which are deeper for sure, and you have a great chance there as well. But I think when it comes to fly fishing, I think we're better off with more shallow lakes, and I think you'll get closer to more fish if you fish more shallow water than you will do on a big lake where it's really deep and you need to use sinking lines and all that.
Sure.
But I do that as well, but I prefer the other ones. So.
Yep.
And another thing is that the pikes here are spawning in May.
Okay.
And we have a period in April we are not allowed to fish. So the best season is from December until end of March. And they're really strong. They're big. And if you don't have a too cold winter, it's you can have some pretty good fishing at that time of the year.
Nice. So how do as far as the life history of pike, I don't know the whole when I guess they spawn, like you said, in May. But are they getting pretty big in these small lakes, and how are they, I guess sounds like there's lots of growth, lots of sun and all that stuff.
It's maybe the advantage of some of these lakes being a little bit over-fertilized. There's a lot of whitefish in these lakes, so they got pretty got a lot of food. So they're growing. I think the downside is that these small lakes get very warm in the summer, so they don't add any weight in the summer. They do it in the fall, winter, and maybe early spring.
Mm-hmm.
So it's but if you have a healthy lake, they'll still grow pretty big sizes. I think the lake I fish, we have them up to 25 pounds there, something like that.
Wow.
And which is that's
nice.
A decent pike.
Yeah, nice fish.
And the same thing you'll find in a lot of waters in Sweden, especially the northern part of Sweden. You have a lot of easy accessible, good pike lakes up there because there don't live a lot of people up there, and it is not fished hard for pike. They're more into trout, grayling, salmon and all that. So you could, even though pike fishing has become more and more popular as well, so it's still a small sport. But you probably, I think, one of the most important guys over here making this pike fishing popular is Niklas Bauer, and he's done a great work in and it is also a way to now I'm talking something about something else, but it's also a way of attracting young people to fly fishing actually, because pike is easy accessible. It's not expensive. You don't need a lot of expensive gear either. So it's a really good way to start fly fishing. And that's for pike,
that's
especially in countries like Sweden, where you have a lot of lakes. It's easy to, everybody has a lake within maybe 5 miles of the house. So it's just, you can just go there.
Yeah. As opposed to Atlantic salmon, I guess, is the extreme, right? That's where, that's the extreme version. But no, that's a good point.
And even trout fishing over here is not that easy accessible, to be honest. I think you're lucky in the US. It is pretty easy to access good fishing in the US. It's not as easy over here, I would say. So it's not in Denmark, at least. Sweden is easier.
That's right. That's pretty cool to have pike. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, pike seems like it's really kind of, I don't know if it's blowing up yet, but people realize that, pike's an amazing fish to get into. Can you bring us to the water? I mean, what are you fishing out of, or are you waiting? I mean, take us to the water. Say one of those 2-acre lake or ponds, you're going for pike. You know, talk about the rod, reel, line.
Yeah.
And then what you're using to get into these fish.
Exactly. I'm using a float tube. I'm a float tube guy.
Perfect.
I've done it for almost 20 years now, and I love it.
What float tube? Do you have a name of a company you like? Or
Outcast. Right now I have an Outcast Prowler. It's a fantastic float tube. Yeah, really good quality, and I really love my float tube. I've tried kayaks. I've tried other kind of boats and things like that, but I'll never be a boat guy. I'm a float tube guy. So that's what I do. And it's, you know, and the, in these small lakes, you don't need a boat. You don't need a kayak, anything else. It's much easier to get around in your float tube. So a typical day there would be, my float tube packed with fly boxes and 2 rods normally, one for surface fishing and one for streamers. I prefer around 6 to 8 weight. I know that's probably a little bit lighter than what you hear maybe in the US and even from the Dutch guys. The Dutch guys are using 10 weights, 12 weights. I think the reason for that, actually, there's a difference between countries there, is that in Holland or in Netherlands, the fish were really big, very big flies, quite heavy, with a lot of material, because the lakes are very unclear.
All right.
So I think they need a bigger rod to cast these big streamers. And up here, where you may be fishing clearer water, you can fish a little smaller flies and lighter flies as well, which you can easily cast on a 6 weight using a shooting head or something like that. So it's so that's my normal setup. It's a shooting head system. I do have both floating and intermediate and sinking lines for the lakes. For the shallow lakes, I always use my intermediate line for streamers and my floating light if I use a popper or a surface lure or something like that.
Perfect.
So it's and then the fishing there in general, when you fish winter, it's pretty cold water. So you need, I think there's a few things you need to pay attention to when you fish for in the winter, is you need to fish slowly. So you can't use really heavy flies with big lead eyes or anything like that. It will sink too fast. So lightweight flies on a light, maybe intermediate line is what I'm preferring. And fish them pretty slowly. Normally, if it's a cold winter, you only get one chance with each fish, because they're using a lot of energy to attack your bait. They will even use a lot of energy to attack a small fish as well, for sure. So you need to get them when you got, you need to hook them when you get the attack. So I think slow retrieves and and not too big flies is that's what I'm using. And it works pretty good.
Gotcha. And is the retrieve, the slow retrieve, is that kind of like what are you doing? Like pulling, what does that retrieve look like? Are you mixing up quite a bit, or is there a pretty standard retrieve in the winter?
Yeah, it's pretty standard, but I like to, especially in the winter, I prefer to pause quite a lot because it seems like they even have a lot of takes when the fly was just kind of hovering in the water. And I think a lot of people forget that a little bit, especially in the winter. It doesn't matter in the summer, but in the winter you need to pause a lot. And even sometimes when I've finished the retrieve, I just let the fly hang in the water just in front of me. And I have quite a few takes right in front of me because it seems like you just follow the fly maybe for 8 or 10 meters without attacking. And then when it stands still in front of the belly boat, they can't resist and they attack anyhow. So yeah, slow retrieves. Another small thing here, a small tip maybe, is that don't fish with flies that have too long tails in the winter. It seems like pike have a tendency to attack more often behind when the water's cold, as to when it's warmer, they attack more from the side. So you will have a lot of takes just, you know, maybe just attacking. If they take the fly directly from behind it, it will only bite the tail if you have too long a tail. So it's shorter tails. Maybe even you can use the trailer hook as well. I'm not too happy about having two hooks on my flies, but if you do it, it will increase catches, I think, if you have a trailer hook, or just make the tail shorter.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. That's some good tips there. So, and when you talk about flies, maybe we could just jump into, I have a little segment, the 222, which is top two flies, top two tips, top two resources. And, you know, for this, if we're talking about flies, what pattern, if you're describing that, you know, we're in a shallow or 3 to 6 foot lake and you're kind of out there fishing in your float tube, what would be a couple of good patterns we might be able to look up online?
I'm really a big fan of Popovich's flies. I think he's very lightweight, easy to cast. So my patterns are variations of beast flies, you could say, reverse tide bucktails and all that. Color-wise, black, maybe, probably black is number one, white number two. He also Popovich classics, I would say, if you read his books. White is his number one and black is number two, but for me it's vice versa a little bit. But I think both work really, really well. For me it's not so much about patterns. It's more important that they are super lightweight. Even have flies made just out of Flashaboo, which is spun in a dubbing loop and then turn around the hook, and it creates a very lively fly which is very lightweight. So I think weight for me is more important than how the fly is dressed or if it's a specific pattern. But if you're looking to patterns, Bob Popovich for sure.
Okay.
He knows what he's doing.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And Brammer, for sure, Gunnar Brammer.
Yeah.
Same thing. I think he is inspired by Popovich as well. I think we all are when it comes to these big flies. He's such an important fly tyer, and I think all of us are inspired more or less by him. It comes from him.
Gunnar did talk about Popovich, and I haven't had him on yet, but we've talked on email, so we'll get him on as well sometime soon. Okay, so, and then the color wise,
I'll listen to that one.
Oh, good.
He's the master in my world.
What question, if you had to ask Popovich a question, what would you have, one that would come to mind, or do you pretty much, have you read all the stuff, you know, kind of all his you know, how he does
I've read all his stuff for sure. I think you need to if you're really keen on predator fishing. It doesn't matter if it's pike or muskie or bass, but all these big predators, I think you need to read his books. I would probably ask him where he got all, because he must have fished quite a lot. Otherwise, he's a very smart guy who can figure it out. I think what I like about his book is it's based on facts. Actually, he has fished a lot. He must have. So I would just curious how much how he does get that much time for fishing,
exactly.
And developing all these techniques and doing it so well.
That's right.
So he's, yeah.
That's right. So you mentioned the flashaboo fly. So is that fly, so you're just literally, it's just a white or black, kind of a bright, thinly designed flashaboo fly?
No, the flashaboo flies I normally do in other colors. I think it's more the beast flies I do in black and white. I do have flash flies in black as well. But they got a similar design, you could say. But I think with the flash, you can add more color to it, like gold, silver, and yeah, whatever color you would like. I think today you can get almost all colors in flashaboo. So it's
everything,
and even holographics and pearls and all that. Right. So there's a lot of, so you can. But to be be honest, and I tried so many different colors, and it seems like the more you fish, the fewer flies you actually use. I think you're getting your basics right, and I know it sounds boring, but it do come down to black, silver, gold, copper, and black and white when it comes to the beasts and bucktail flies. Yeah, it is. And the chartreuse now and then, for sure. The chartreuse.
Oh, chartreuse! Right, important. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. And what
for
would
some
be,
reason.
What would be your hook that you guys have that would be good with those flies, or is there a number of different ones you might use for?
Yeah, I have one hook in particular actually, which, and then we are back to the names and naming, which is actually a hook out of the Trout Predator series. It's called the 615. It's a long shanked lightweight hook in and I use a 4.0, which is my preferred size for pike fishing. And then they just pinch the barb because we don't need barbs on pike fly fishing, to be honest. Back to naming it is difficult because trout predator and predator overlaps quite a lot. So I use the Trout Predator 615 and even the 610. It's two good hooks for that. As long as they're lightweight and strong enough to hold a big fish. And I think the 615 is that. It might be something different if you're fishing a big stream or where you have a lot of power in the water. But I think for pond fishing, you don't need anything else than that, to be honest.
That's what it sounds like. Your area maybe is a little unique. I know the cool thing is there's lots of small ponds all around the world. So that's a great thing. But yeah, I mean, like you said, lots of guys, there's guys fishing in deeper water and dark, water that they can't, the visibility isn't as good. So there's all sorts of different conditions, but for the condition you're describing, which is pretty clear water in the winter, a light hook. And that's the way I'd love, because except to me, casting a gigantic heavy and using a 12 weight or right. Or even a Ted weight is, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun, although rods are better now, obviously, than they used to be. What's your recommendation? Do you have a rod, company or anything you like to use out there?
Yeah, I'm a Scott guy when it comes to rods. Right now I fish for pike. I use my Radian 908, which is a very good rod, and even tried the new saltwater rods for pike fishing, new Scott Sector. And I don't know how much you're into Scott rods, but I think in my opinion, for pike fishing at least, I'm not the saltwater guys need to talk about saltwater fishing with the new rods, but I think Scott has made a really, really good pike rod in the new Scott Sector, even though it's meant for salt water, because it's much more forgiving than the old Meridian they had. I think a lot of salt water guys preferred the Meridian because it could cast longer and all that. But for practical fishing, sitting in a float tube, Scott Sector 8 weight is perfect for that, and it's not too stiff. It's a really nice rod for that. So yeah, Radians or Scott Sectors, that's the two rods I prefer for that.
Perfect.
Great rods, both of
them.
Yeah,
that's great. Yeah, I haven't used a Scott too often, but I know the I'll have to check our local fly shop. I have a we have an affiliate deal set up with our local the Gorge Fly Shop. So if anybody listening out there, I wanted to check out. I believe they have Scott, but I'll have to double check. If they do, I'll put a link in the show notes to that rod you're talking about. Those rods. So
and when it comes to reels and lines and all that, it's as I said, it's more for me, it's a shooting head system, and I use scientific anglers for that. There's a lot of good lines out there, but scientific anglers, and I've always been scientific anglers for me, so that's what I'm using.
There you go.
And for reels, it's waterway slams and reels, but it could be anything. Like the design. I think, you know, Scandinavians and design is something that lives together. So I think the waterway slams and reels are appealing to me. So it's nice reels, really nice reels.
Yeah, there's a ton of good stuff. Okay, well, let's keep. So we got the flies on that 222. So, and you mentioned some tips. Any other, a couple of tips you want to throw out there for fishing, like we're talking about for pike?
Yeah, I think I have a few small. It's small things, but that's something. You know how that is. It's sometimes the small things are the most important. One thing I actually just discovered recently. I've had a really hard time to find the right wire for pike fishing. I just noticed that. It's not because I have any gain from this, but I think the new scientific anglers just made a new 7x7 strand wire, which is really, really nice for pike fishing. They got a 25 pounds and a 45 pounds on that one, and I prefer the 25 pounds. It's just a fantastic wire. And it's knottable. You can make your knots on it and all that. It's really nice to use. And I just connect it to a piece of fluorocarbon. It doesn't matter what kind of you can use.
What's the knot you use? What do you to tie it?
Between the wire and the monofilament or maybe fluorocarbon, I'd use just a surgeon's knot. Or if you even know what to, you can even use, I think you got some connectors now. I think it was Not Too Kinky made some connectors many years ago. I still have a few of those where you have two small holes where you do your knot and all that. They're quite nice.
Okay.
And then I use just a small snap lock to tie on the, put on the fly.
Yeah.
I know that's small things, but it is really hard to find the right wire. I don't want it to be too stiff or too soft.
Right.
You don't want to curl up when you got the first pike. And I've seen a lot of wires just curl when you had the first fish. And that's really annoying, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So it was just a small thing, but
That's great. That's great.
Yeah. So, and bring a towel when you're pike fishing in the winter. Your hands will get cold.
Oh, bring a towel just to keep your hands warm?
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. What is it like? What is it? If you're out there in December, you know, how cold does it get out there? Can it get?
Yeah, I'm not so good with Fahrenheit, but in Denmark it will be 0 degrees, and I'm not sure what it is in Fahrenheit. But it's just before it's the
freezing. Yeah.
Yeah, before it's
so it doesn't get freezing. So yeah, you're not getting down to like way below zero.
No, otherwise the lakes will just freeze up, and we're not. So I'm trying to, and you know that's the backside of all this with the climate change and all that. I think we don't have ice in the winters anymore, which is good for fishing. I'm not sure if it's good for the nature, but it allows us to fish all year round now. Actually, I think it's more than 4 or 5 years ago that we couldn't go fishing in the winter. So it is getting warmer here as well, as it is everywhere in the world, I think. So it's which allows us to fish more for pike in the winter, but
the global warming. We won't dig in too much on that. There's a whole I'd love to dig into it too, because there's a lot of good stuff there, including like I have a friend that we just he was doing some work at his property, and he got a new Tesla. He had a new Tesla in the garage, and I haven't even driven in a Tesla yet. But you know, it just goes back to that thing, like all this stuff. And that's the cool thing about fly fishing is, right, we're all in this industry. It's really conservation minded. So I think that's one of the great things. Do you notice that in Denmark? You guys are probably ahead of the curve on a lot of that stuff. Is kind of conservation, all that stuff, pretty hot topic over there?
I think we are probably better at working on renewable energy and things like that than we are on
Yeah.
Because Denmark is an agricultural country, so we have a lot of farming around here. And, you know, when a country have a lot of farming, you always have issues around that.
Farming first.
Because it's important.
Farming's
yeah,
first.
It's important. Exactly. And it's important for the country that the farmers can do what they're doing and all that.
You guys don't have really like a, you know, necessarily an endangered species where that takes precedent over the agriculture sort of thing.
We do have that in some cases, I would say, but I don't think it works really, really well, to be honest. I think we can learn more about this from other countries, but I think a lot of things are good here because, as I said, we got a lot of wind energy here now, and I think today it's more than, I think Denmark is covered with, I think 60% of the use of energy in Denmark comes from wind. So it is, I think there we are ahead of the curve, but that's important for our nature and what we have here as well. But it is just, sometimes you still see cases where you get polluted streams and from farming and all that. It's not over yet.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. We mentioned at the start about some of your books. Can you just describe, I'm not sure how many books you have out there, but yeah, a couple of your books.
Yeah, isn't it? It's the back in the days. I was younger.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I think the last book I made was maybe, I can't remember. It's almost,
it's been a while.
Almost 20 years ago.
Oh, wow.
I think.
That's cool.
Yeah. It's
what got you in? Well, maybe just I don't know if you wanted to talk about, maybe just pick one out that we can. Can you still find these books out there anywhere?
I'm not sure. I don't think they're available anymore, to be honest. It was about fly tying. It's always been about fly fishing and fly tying. And these were fly tying books. I was not more than 30 years old. So it's almost 25 years ago, to be honest.
There you go.
So it's I knew it all back then.
Yeah,
you know that when you're younger, you know it all.
That's right.
Now
so,
I don't know it.
So do you have do you want to throw out a name so we can try to dig it up on the Google machine or?
I think if you just Google my name and write books, I think you'll probably find it.
So if you looked at that book now, you picked it up and you read it, would you be happy with reading it, or would it kind of make you cringe a little bit?
No, I think I'll still be happy because it was kind of, you know. If you look, you probably have it the same way. When you look back at things you've done when you were younger, you can still kind of imagine how it was when you had that age. And you thought, as I said with that book, I think we put in maybe 100 patterns we used at that time.
Oh, cool.
I probably not use a lot of those patterns today, but we thought
that's awesome.
That was what we loved back then. And it was, it's kind of a time machine, you can say. And,
exactly.
And you can look back at it. And I'm still proud of what we did there. And I still have a few of those flies in my boxes, so it was not too bad.
There you go.
But for sure, we are in an evolving hobby. So I think, especially the last 10 years, I think a lot of things have happened. I think we're getting closer and closer to from what you see in the spinning and lure industry and trying to recreate that with our flies. And a lot of things have changed. In a better way, to be honest. It's not locked anymore. You must do it like this. You must have 5 wraps of tinsel on your salmon fly, otherwise it wouldn't work. And that's what I grew up with. So it's, I think it's positive that people are so creative now.
Good deal. Cool. So as far as resources, you obviously, you know, we talked about Popovich. Any other books, magazines, people we might want to look at to kind of dig into pike fishing a little more?
I must say I'm very much into books. I still are, and I still am. It's a very fantastic resource and I think you have some really good writers in the U.S. We mentioned Bob Popovich, but there's a lot of other guys out there doing a really good job, and they have so much knowledge. And I'm thankfully, they still want to share it in books and not just on. Rick Stolis just came out with a book, and it is books like that are very important to me. And Pat Cohn, I think.
Yep.
So it's important. I think I'm happy that there's still publisher out there that wants to do books. I know it's difficult these days because a lot of things are online today, but I think we should support and still buy books and learn from them. It's
definitely.
And yeah. I do for sure.
That's great. Yeah. I will put a link to I actually had recently, Rich Strollis and Pat Cohen on different episodes. I'll put links.
Yeah.
They were great. Yeah. Pat.
Yeah, sure.
Pat talked about tying the big, all the deer hair stuff. And I'm sure he probably mentioned your hooks as well. And then Rich Strollis definitely mentioned you guys. He said he loves your hooks as well. So yeah, it's all, obviously a cool little, you're good. I mean, those guys are tying the big stuff and that's what you special. I mean, would you say your company, I mean, as we start to wrap this thing up, do you specialize more? That is your thing, the big hooks, the big, more than some of the other types of hooks?
Yeah, I think you're right there, actually. Even though that we want to kind of cover it all, I think we have become known as the brand who takes care of the big hooks, I must say. So we're selling more big hooks than small hooks. We do have a pretty big freshwater series with all the dry fly and nymphs and all that as well, and which is just as important as it is with all the big hooks. But I think that's where we came from, and I think there's a lot more good freshwater hooks out there like nymphs and dries and all that. I think we kind of. The big hooks was a smaller niche, you can say, and we kind of covered that in the beginning, and I think people recognize that. So yeah, I think I agree that we're probably more known for the big hooks than the small hooks.
That's perfect.
I would say
that's perfect. So I got a couple questions to take us out of here, and one of them, you mentioned at the start, I think you got fishing when you were 17 or in that range. If you look back at your, let's say your 20-year-old self, back when you were 20, this is a while back. I mean, what advice would you give? What advice would you give to that kid that maybe would help him?
Yeah, I would say one thing that has been really, really important for me is not just to be locked in one species. Try fish with the fly for all species you can find. It's so you learn so much, and I fish for all kind of species. It doesn't matter what species I'm looking for. I think it's still fun, and you learn so much from. You can use some of the techniques you use for pike. You can use that for. Some of the saltwater species and vice versa. So I think that's don't be too narrow-minded. I would actually
And the same flies. You're using a pike fly on different species.
Exactly, and you can maybe downsize it a little bit for other species, or you can upsize it if you need to do that. So it's maybe a few other colors and maybe another hook, and you can do these small tweaks to your cool. patterns. But yeah, but I think, and I see that more and more and. A lot of people are getting focused on just one species, salmon, for example. And I think, I wouldn't say it's wrong, but I just think it's if you're a young angler and just, I think you should keep an eye out and try as much as you can and just enjoy fly
That's
fishing.
Right. That's right. Yeah. I'll second that. I have a friend, Greg Weisgerber, is a good buddy of mine. He just loves fly tying, and I'm not sure if he uses your hooks or not, but he tied me some flies for salt water, just some basic stuff on my last, just some general stuff, man. But I've been using this little fly. I don't even know what he calls it, but I was just fishing for smallmouth bass with my kids, and that was the best fly. So, it's just like, especially these flies where they're just, I don't know, they're flashy, that you can use them on also. And I'm sure it would work on trout as well in the right condition.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in general, I think that's what's happening this year. People are more aware of all the species we can fish on a fly. It's not just trout and salmon and bass anymore. It's everything everything you can imagine. So also because you have a lot of development in lines and rods and reels, and flies and hooks, so you can actually target every species you want. It's not impossible anymore. And
do you have a species on your bucket list you haven't hit yet, but that you want to get to before we head out of here?
I can't remember the name. I was communicating with a friend on Instagram. He's from Oh, some part of the southern part of the U.S. where you had, but it doesn't really matter. I just thought it was very beautiful. I'll have to look the name up. You can put it on the comments, and I'll look it up and see what species it was. That's actually on my bucket. It's probably pretty common fish. I just thought it looked really beautiful.
Gotcha. I wonder if it's some sort of like a sunfish, like a bluegill or something like that, or something like a
bluegill. Yeah, I don't think it was one of those, but it's probably in the same family. Something I would close. Say. I'll look it up. I have it somewhere in my.
Yeah, that's cool. No, I'm interested to hear. We'll put a link to that. And then what about on your, you obviously tie a lot of flies, and you've got Instagram, you're doing a great job there. What do you,
thank you.
You know, what's your vice? What's your vice you use? And then we'll talk about your other vice here, but what's your vice of choice in it right now?
It's a Regal. Okay. I must say it's
Regals are great.
There's a lot of fantastic vices out there, but I think it's a really reliable vice. It's been around for many, many years, and it's super durable and all that, and easy to use. So yeah, I use my Regal.
What about your vice? So this is on a different, I'm not sure if the language conversion, but you know, vice, what, anything you do that maybe is something you've had to quit in your life, or something that's kind of been maybe a negative thing that you've, you know, you've partaken in. It could be, you know, like some people were smoking and they had to quit. Anything like that, that you can give us a little insight into your history?
Oh, that was a good one.
I'm putting you on the spot here, but I can tell you my, I'll tell you my, I haven't really talked about this too much, but for years, I chewed tobacco, which is a really disgusting habit, you know, tobacco. It's over here, it's kind of, you know, I guess it used to be maybe a popular thing, but I quit that when my first kid was born. And, you know, and it's been the greatest thing ever, quitting it, because I'm just obviously healthier and all that stuff. But I'm not sure if you have something like that, or if it's just like,
no, I think I get what you mean. And I think I'm constantly reminded about it. And actually, now you bring it up, I should maybe pay attention to that again. It's also something to do with the conservation, actually. It's the whole kick plastic thing.
Oh, right.
I do buy too many soft drinks in plastic. Yep. I should kick plastic.
Yep, that's a great. It is a hard one to do.
I'm really bad at that, to be honest. And you know, being in this industry and doing what we do and love it so much, we do have a system over here where we can hand the plastic bottles back to the shop and get paid and all that, which is fantastic. I do that. I don't throw them out just in the garbage can and all that, but I still think I could do better on that. I would say yes, that's plastic. What I would do.
I love it. What about A-Rex hooks? Anything that nobody knows about, something a little insider stuff that maybe you've never told anybody? What would be a little thing that nobody, what does nobody know about your company that maybe is interesting?
No, okay. I thought it was something new coming out. I can tell you a little secret. I can tell you, yeah. We have something going with Gunnar Brammer.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. A new hook design.
Oh, there you go. So that's coming out in the next 6 months or a year or so.
Yeah. They will probably be out in October or something like that. Hopefully we'll get the first hooks in August.
All right. Perfect. Perfect. We'll stay tuned for that and all.
That's a pretty rad fly hook. I can tell you that. I don't think you haven't seen anything out there like it.
Nice.
I don't know if people will like it. We'll see. It's a very special thing, actually. So.
Yep.
That's best kept secret I have.
There you go. That's awesome. I'll leave it at that, Morten. I just wanted to thank you for coming on and sharing a little insight into kind of what you have going and some tips on pike. And yeah, just appreciate you coming on, and we'll keep in touch with you as we move forward here.
And thank you for having me. It was a big pleasure. I hope you can understand all my English with Danish accent.
Oh yeah, you did awesome. I loved it. So yeah, we'll talk to you soon. All right. Okay. See ya.
Great. Thanks.
So there you go. If you want to find all of the show notes with all the links we covered, just go to wetflyswing.com/150. That is 150 episodes. And that's actually technically, I don't know exactly, but there's more because we actually had some that weren't listed with episode numbers, but we're just going to keep it at 150. And I just wanted to say, holy crap, that's a lot. Since December of 2017, I have not missed a single week of podcasting. I've been coming to you every Tuesday with new episodes, so I'm very happy that you are with me on this journey. I'm happy that you found some helpful information along the way, some entertaining stories, a better connection with the natural world, with this community. Maybe you've connected with somebody along the way, maybe met somebody new, talked to somebody, learned about somebody. And I feel like 150 more episodes is going to be even better than the first. I can't say it's been easy all the time, you know, to stick with it, but I just feel like I'm going to keep pushing this thing stronger. So I look forward to hearing from you and to better understand where you're coming from, what's going on, and to keep you up to date on the show. This is not my show. I feel very strongly about that. This is definitely your show. So I love to hear from you. And if you haven't checked in with me, please take a moment. If you've never connected with me and let me know who you are, I'd love to hear about you. I'd love to hear your story. I'd love to celebrate, celebrate what we have going. 150, right? I mean, this is, I'm not sure if you've listened to all 150 episodes in the past. If you've listened to one or all 150, I feel like it's just been totally amazing. So just want to just say thank you again. And the little surprise here is I've got a little early intro into a poetry read. If you wanted to potentially read some of the poetry coming up, I'd like to hear from you on that too, because I'd like to find some other people that could do this. So let's jump into this. No business. I weighed remnants of No Business Creek. There used to be a still tucked up the gulch beyond the shack we tore down. Folks would say he had no business being up there. Creek trips into river, blends, bends right, cottonwood angles over a deep cut. In August heat, we strip and sink, wash off work dust in the shade. September, I come alone to cast short flicks over shadows, snagging flies in bushes. Practice in patience, the untangling. A hit of pleasure at a fly precisely placed, white hackles bobbing, sometimes lost in bursts of light on water. The surface of the world is warming, waking. No business needs my attention. Morning slips into day, the still air undisturbed by speech. Nora Esty holds a doctorate in mathematics from UC Berkeley and published articles on topological dynamics. She now lives off the grid in Eastern Oregon, writing poetry, raising sheep, and fly fishing. That sounds like an amazing an amazing person, an amazing life. Nora, not sure if you're listening to this, but I hope to meet you, and I appreciate you for sharing the poetry, and that's awesome. Man, off the grid. Oregon poetry. You know, right now, August, I guess right now it's August when we're doing this, or it's actually not August, it's July right now. It's July when I'm reading this, but when this goes out, when you're listening to it, if you're listening to it right away, it's going to be August. Maybe it's, and that's August of 2021. You also might be listening to this in August of 2030. Could you imagine that? 2030. I'll be in my 50s. Anyways, you know how much I love the podcast, the podcasting. I've got a bunch of stuff going on, and you know, appreciate being alive. So let's make the most of this year and get on the water. Thanks, everyone. See you soon. Let's do one more read. One more read. I weighed remnants of No Business Creek. There used to be a still tucked up the gulch beyond the shack we tore down. Folks would say he had no business being up there. Creek trips into rivers, blends, bends right. That's wrong. All right, one last time. If I don't get it, I'm going to skip it. I weighed remnants of No Business Creek. There used to be a still tucked up the gulch beyond the shack we tore down. Folks would say he had no business being up there. Creek trips into river, blends, bends right. Cottonwood angles over a deep cut. In August heat, we strip and sink, wash off work dust in the shade. September, I come alone to cast short flicks over shadows. I'm going to skip it because I just made an error and the other one was just one letter, and I'm going to stop there and just call it good. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. I'm going to leave these cuts in as bonus. As you can see that I definitely take multiple cuts and I'm not perfect. Actually, if you've been listening to this, you know that I'm not perfect because I've made plenty of errors along the way, but as all good, as any people that are, if you want to get good at something, what's the secret? Keep doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it. All right. Have a good night. What is the best takeaway, or not takeaway? What's the best message to leave off on? The best message to leave off, or the best single word you could say. Love is the answer.